morning, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Dropping the Gloves. Thank you for joining us. Tim, it's not often I get a player to come on the show who I kind of look up to, who when I was playing, I kind of molded my game after him. And it's not a stretch to say that this guy was a modern day Renaissance man. You know, he kind of does it all. He's shirking now, but he was. You want to play physical? Let's go. We'll play physical. I'll bury you through the boards. You want to score goals? All right, I'll put two or three on the board. You want to fight? I'll crush your face in. Whatever you want to do, I will do it, and I will do it better than you. Shea Weber? Better than Shea Weber. More talented, tougher. A power play specialist? He's the best that's ever existed. He holds the records for most power play goals in a season with 19. I'm very happy to have this guy in our show. I was terrified of him during my playing years. I played against him many times. I watched him destroy one of my teammates in Craig Weller while I was in the press box, thankfully eating popcorn and just getting fat. Sheldon Surrey is joining the show. Thank you, Sheldon, for joining us, my man.
Buddy, man, I wish you were my agent. Wow, that was that was some crazy stuff right there.
That came to me yesterday. Yesterday, honestly, I was thinking about this. I'm like, Sheldon Surrey. I'm like, this guy, because I was just behind you. I was born in 82. I think you were born in 70-ish.
Six.
Yeah. I was just behind you. So when I was entering the league, when I was trying to take that next step, I'm like, who do you want to pattern your game after? And I was taller. I wasn't as good as you, but I'm like, man, this guy does it all. Oh, like it, literally tough, can put points on the board, got a cannon of a shot, responsible defensively, does everything, absolutely everything, right? Correct me if I'm wrong, Sheldon.
I think you are exaggerating greatly the the level of skill I had, but it's very nice of you to say. I tried to get better as I went along. I mean, you know, starting out, you know how it is. You kind of have to prove yourself, and then guys like you come in the league, and I can't punch that far above my league. So, you know, it was kind of a gradual progression. I think, you know, when I first started, I was in New Jersey and I was put in a little bit of a box of how they wanted me to play. And that style at that time kind of fit what I was doing. You know, Kenny Danico was getting a little older and Lalo Line was getting a little older. I certainly didn't think I was Scott Stevens, but you know, they needed someone to maybe take a little pressure off that. And, you know, I think especially early in my career in New Jersey, I kind of accepted that. And, I was fine with it, you know, playing 10, 12 minutes a night, being the sixth, seventh guy and, you know, kind of contributing where I can. I mean, back in the day, you know, all you had to do was cross check good. You know, if you could clear the crease out, then you were doing your job. But as I started going along, I got maybe some more opportunity. I got different perspective. And, as you know, having to fight is the hardest job in hockey. There's just no question about it. It's just the hardest thing. There's so much pressure on you. And I didn't like that. And I knew that there's guys like you and the Boogeyman and the list goes on, right? McGrattan and the list just keeps going on. And I wasn't going to be in the league long if I was trying to keep up with those guys. So it was just kind of an evolution and luck, you know, getting put in the right opportunities. And anybody could score goals on the power play with Andre Markov or Alexei Kovalev, you know, saucering you the puck across the seam. So I was a benefit of, you know, playing with really good players.
Well, it's easy to say that, but there was probably 50 other guys who were put in that same spot who didn't amount to nothing. So you obviously had to have some kind of talent. But let's go back to Jersey. You mentioned they were trying to put you in a box. And I was in that same situation where I was coming in. I came out of college. I didn't fight. You know, I spent 4 years at Michigan Tech just working on how to make a pass and, you know, high and hard off the glass. So I was thrust into this role as like, okay, you're going to be fighting the toughest guys in the world on a nightly basis, like heads up, because just your size. So what box were they trying to make you put into? Because you had a good final season in the Dub. You came in, I think you had 54 points that year. You split it between Prince George and Kelowna. So you were successful, but you also racked up 180 penalty minutes. So this wasn't foreign to you. So you're in Albany trying to work your way to the Devils. What were they trying to mold you to be? Kind of like, give us the conversations that were going on between you, your agent, and the coaches. Cause I always find this interesting where you're a skilled guy and they're trying to make you do, was it, you say you didn't want to, but what's going on in your head there?
Well, I think, you know, the way that New Jersey was playing back in the day was a rough and tumble, simple, very clean defensive game. Like, yeah. You know, we were happy to win games 1-0, 2-1, you know, get 15 shots against. Like, we're kind of that kind of team organization. And I knew that I had that skill set in junior, but as you know, junior in NHL is a lot different. Everyone's good in the NHL, right? And so yeah. I think what they had told me was, you know, there's some guys like Kenny Danico is probably the guy they were grooming me to replace. And Kenny wasn't playing the power play. He was being a tough physical guy. He was being a good teammate. Then we had guys in the minor like Jason Smith, Cale Hulse. So we had all these tough dudes who were, you know, really good defensemen. And I think once I got my opportunity, yeah. I think Kenny Danico got hurt or maybe he went to treatment or something like that. And I got an opportunity. So I slid in there not thinking that I was going to be Scott Niedermeyer. You know, so I knew I wasn't going to be playing the power play or whatever. So I think it was just, you know, they just had all these interchangeable parts. And the interchangeable part for me was a guy like Kenny Danico. So I just keep it simple. Don't get any trouble and be a good teammate was kind of the box. I feel like, you know, maybe they didn't put me in it, but I definitely wasn't thinking that I was there to do anything different than, you know, than that.
High and hard off the glass.
That's it.
That's simple. All you had to do to survive. And so you survived that first year. This was before their Stanley Cup success. So they were growing something there with the Devils. Could you see the ingredients there with the Stevens, the Niedermeyers, those types of players? They were still young like you. Did you feel this camaraderie? Like, here we go, fellas. Like, cause you were up there the next 2-3 years.
Yeah. Well, the year I got drafted, they had lost in the semifinal to the Rangers. Mm-hmm. The year that I got drafted and then played in Albany and then and was a black ace in New Jersey, won the cup in Albany, the Calder Cup. And then New Jersey won the cup that year. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, oh man, this is easy. This is how it's going to be forever. That wasn't that hard. And then we were the President's Trophy winners, I think a couple of years. We lost in the first round 1 year to Ottawa. And then the next year we lost maybe in the second round. And so they needed to change something. And to be honest with you, I kind of seen the writing on the wall. At the time, the coach who was there and I weren't seeing eye to eye. I probably wasn't as dedicated to the game as they would have liked me to be, you know, young guy living in New York. I was just happy to be there. And so I probably shortchanged myself and them a little bit. I have all the respect in the world for Lou Lamoriello. He told me how it was. He gave it to me, you know, straight. There was no black and white. And, you know, at the time he was making the move to make the Devils, but, and then they won the cup that year. I got traded right before the trade deadline. They won that year in 2000. So,
which is fun.
Yeah, that's great. Just watching them play, you know, being out of the playoffs and then watching them win the cup. That was a fun summer. But you know what? I will tell you just the level of class that organization has. So the next year they win the cup. I go to Montreal the next year around Christmas time. I get a Christmas card from the owner of the Devils and he loved his dogs more than he loved anybody. He loved his dogs. So there's a picture of him and his dog sitting in the Stanley Cup. And I'm like, you, and I open it up and there's a full playoff share bonus. And he said, hey, you were a big part of this. And, you know, just want you to know that we appreciated what you did and everything. And I, you know, I was floored. I mean, at the time I wasn't making a lot of money.
Wow.
And I remember calling Lou Lamoriello and saying, hey man, this is like, I'm blown away. Thank you guys. And that was kind of honestly a jumping off point for me and being like, hey man, like I can do this. Like, someone seen something in me to think this. And I just remember saying to myself, like, I have to be better. I have to give more and be better.
No kidding. So that one little act of kindness by the owner or the president changed your mindset that much. Crazy.
Yeah, it was, I didn't get new. Look, and you know this as well as anybody. If you're looking for compliments and, hey, good job.
Yeah, you're not going to find it.
That's not how it works, right? So I think I had always been, you need to do this, you need to do that. I'd always been told that. So I always felt like this pressure of like, man, I'm not doing good enough, you know. And that's the truth. I just wasn't unlocking my potential, I guess. But I felt like someone seen that in that moment. And the talk I had with Lou about, you know, he traded me for my benefit to go and be better and, you know, flourish in a different system. It just gave me a real shot of confidence and a mindset of like, wow, this is the big leagues. Like, you have to, you know, a little less after the game, you know, fun, and a little more dedication to the craft.
So before we move on from the Devils, I want to ask, you come up with this team, you're 21, 22 years old, and there's two of the best defensemen ever to play the game on the blue line with you. Very different players, Stevens and Niedermeyer. What did you learn from each of them? Did they teach you stuff? Did you model your game after little things that they did? What was that like?
I mean, those are two great examples. Scotty Stevens was like an idol for me. Him and Chris Chelios were the two guys that I was like, wow, if I could, you know, play against them one game, my life would be set. And Scotty Stevens showed me what it was to come to work every day, every practice, and be a professional. Like, every day was, our practices were harder than our games sometimes, you know. And he was a no nonsense guy, and I love that he would stick out. You know, he was going out and fighting Lindros, and when Lindros was a menace. So I really learned what it's like to be a professional from him. And Scotty Niedermeyer, I just watched him in admiration. Like, I felt like a fan when I watched him play. Just complete class. And I think what I learned from him probably is not to take everything. Not everything is so, you know, those are two different guys, right? Scott Stevens is like a come to the rink. He's biting glass and spitting nails and he's just ready to go. And Scotty Niedermeyer is like, doesn't have a drop of sweat on him. He just played 27 minutes and he's got his skate laces undone and intermissions. And so two very different guys, but both just such leaders. And the other thing those guys did, even that whole team, that whole organization, which I still admire to this day, is they took care of the young guys. Like, we were all a team. There wasn't like, Scott Stevens is, you know, up here, perennial all-star, and then Scott and Marty Brodeur, don't forget him, right? So we had all these guys, and it was just really a team. And I'd never played on a team ever after that I felt that kind of closeness and camaraderie.
And you think just those three guys, having the top end guys, were the main cause of that, the catalyst of just that environment?
Well, those are three Hall of Famers. We had Debbie Gilmore, who's a, you know, tremendous dude. We had Randy McKay, Bobby Holt. The list just kind of went on. You know, our rookies were Scott Gomez. So we always had high character guys. And you know how it is when you're on a team like that, one bad person can spoil it and you're kind of out. And well, maybe I was that guy because I was out. But, but no, we just had such a good group of guys. And for a young guy, like, that was really a internship in professionalism.
I was just golfing with Randy McKay last week, I think, and he was talking about that fourth line. It was like him, Holik, and somebody else. And that's when Holik was making like $5 million on the fourth line, and he was putting up 60 points.
Yeah. He was, we had who was it? It was Bobby, Randy, the crash line, we called them. And I can't remember who the last guy was, but man, they
unstoppable.
They were just so good. When that's your fourth line, when you have guys going out like that can play.
Yeah.
We were pretty good. I was lucky.
I'll ignore that teams. Little insult at the end there that I can play. I'll let that slide, Sheldon. But, so you leave the Devils. Lou does you a favor. He says, I'm going to trade you for your benefit. Always interesting kind of thing to say from a GM, because I've had GM say that to me too. I'm going to do you a favor here. You get better options here, opportunities. You go to Montreal. Everything's good. I was reading all the comments from the Montreal Canadiens fans. You're loved there. Beloved. They loved you in Montreal. You put up incredible numbers. I'm talking like all-star numbers. You're getting 26 goals, 12 goals, 15 goals. You're putting up insane PIMs. What clicked in Montreal? I'm not saying it didn't click in New Jersey. I know you say you're playing the Ken Danico role. You're more conservative. You're new to the league, so maybe you weren't comfortable. You didn't want to make too many mistakes. 3 years into Montreal, you're all of a sudden an all-star defenseman. What happened?
So my first year there was, you know, pretty forgettable. Nothing. We didn't have a very good team, and, you know, just kind of got through the season. My second full year there, I broke my wrist, and I couldn't get healthy. Like, it just wouldn't heal. I broke the scaphoid bone, which apparently is the worst bone to heal in your wrist. And so I was having like multiple surgeries on this. And I just had my daughter, my oldest daughter. So this, now we're talking like 2003. And the doctor says, well, you might not play again. Like, we don't know if you'll be able to play again or not. And I'm like, well, I'm making $1 million. I'm spending $1.2 million. I just had my kid. I'm going to play, right? And I was sitting in the press box one night in Montreal. There was a couple scouts down for me. And I was just sitting there watching the game. And I remember one guy said, I don't know who they were, but the one guy said the other, you know what Montreal really needs? They need a big, tough defenseman that can really shoot the puck on the power play. And I'm like, well, I can do that. Those are two easy things, right? Those are things that would come natural. That's better than a guy who can quarterback the power play, or better than a guy who can go out there and fight all the toughest guys. So, you know, that kind of really dawned on me. And it was kind of those two things kind of met, where I for sure wasn't going to give up on my career at that point. And if I came back, I wanted to have that opportunity. So I worked my butt off to get back, and you know, someone gets hurt, whether it's Brisbane or someone got hurt on the power play, and you know, we had a bunch of injuries, and I think they just kind of looked down the bench and like, dude, you're up. And like I said, we had the talent we had on our power play was crazy. So much so that, like, I remember on the power play, like, our coach was like, hey, if they shoot the puck down, we don't want you skating back to get it. We don't want you to handle it. Let Markov take it out.
No kidding. Kovalev,
go, swear to God. I'm like, yeah, no problem. So I just skated up the left wing all the time. And once we got in the zone, I just switched over with Marky. So they really dumbed down my, you know, what I had to do, my, my responsibilities. And we just started having a little bit of luck, you know, and then we got a little bit of chemistry, and then all of a sudden we're like on a heater. And the coach, Guy Boucher, was taking me out before and after practices and shooting a ton of pucks. And, you know, he seen something in me that I probably didn't even see in myself. And again, once I felt that, I was like, well, I don't want to let this guy down. I'm getting a pretty decent opportunity here. So things just started going well. And, you know, I really didn't forget that my main job was to be a physical guy who could clear the front of the net and be a good teammate. And then it just started kind of snowballing in a positive way.
There's a few things there I got to unpack, because that's crazy. First of all, that you just overhear a scout saying something and then it just clicks. Hmm. But the big thing for me is I think people forget how mental hockey is. And how confidence in yourself is almost non-existent in the game unless you're one of the top guys. Yeah. Being a third or fourth defenseman or a guy who's in another lineup, to have the head coach spend the time and say, you're my guy, let's go, let's work on it. Like, how much did that just boost your confidence? Because it was always there, Sheldon. Like, you had an incredible shot your whole career. It's not like all of a sudden you fire a couple more hundred pucks and it's like, oh my goodness, look what I just developed. No, you've always had it. What, speak on the mental side, because I think people just think we're robots and it's just like, you go out there and you do it. It's like, what's it like to have the head coach pull you aside and say, you're going to be my guy. I'm going to have Alexei Kovalev, a future Hall of Famer, feed you biscuits and you're going to bombs away.
Yeah, you're right. You know, it's people really see the athletes and the games they play as, oh God, that must be so, it's, you guys are so lucky, you're so fun, right?
You're living the dream. Yeah.
They don't see the other stuff. They don't see the hard work. They don't see the anxiety you have being a third or fourth liner or a fifth or sixth defenseman, not knowing if you're going to be on the team the next. You have a bad game, you could be down in the minors and you could be done, you know? And so there's a lot of like anxiety. There's a lot of mental toughness, a lot of belief in yourself, exactly like you said. And once you start getting an opportunity, you don't want to let it go. Right. You need to be ready for that. And it just happened that, you know, I was getting an opportunity and I felt like someone believed me. I felt like when I got traded, someone believed in me. So it was just kind of a little more of like, hey, you know, I can do this. And when I was in Montreal, by the way, I wasn't looking to step over Scott Stevens or Scott Niedermeyer. Like, I was never going to be a first or second defenseman there. I just wasn't, right? But once I got to Montreal, it was like, I have an opportunity here to change my game a little bit. And so that's just kind of what happened. And it's a lot more comforting knowing, you know, you're a top guy coming in. You don't have this anxiety and pressure just staying in the league, never mind all the extra stuff that goes into it. I don't have to tell you, right? The bag skating, the extra video, the extra weight room. It's a lot. So when you get an opportunity and things, I don't want to say become easier, but they come, it's a different stress. The stress is to produce, not like, wow, am I going to have a job tomorrow? So it just kind of got easier. I really enjoyed that. That kind of people really, obviously they love a good fight, you know that better than anybody, but they also love, like, you know, a slap shot in the top corner on the power play against Toronto Maple Leafs on Saturday night. And that was a better feeling than, you know, having a good fight for me. And so that's kind of where I wanted to get my game to.
Well, and playing in a city that they really acknowledge when you're playing the right way. I remember when I was with Montreal, all of one game, which was a great game. I had a good shift. We had a good shift as a fourth line. It was me and Paulie Byron and I think it was De La Rosa. We grinded it out. We almost scored. We had a good shot on net. Going back to the bench, they standing ovation. Yeah. Like they really appreciated good hockey. And it's kind of neat that they probably saw your progression from the first 3 years there, where it was forgettable. Like you were playing probably solid hockey, but then to see you blossom into this, like, incredible defenseman. Let's just call a spade. You were one of the elite defensemen in the NHL at that point. You put, you know, 81 games, 64 points, still putting up hymns. By the way, let's talk about that. And then we'll move on to the debacle that is known as the Edmonton Oilers. You had 135 minutes in penalties. You had three fights. Fights, the last time I checked, are 5 minutes. So it's 120 penalty minutes of minors. Of tens, were you just cussing out the refs? Were you got your feelings hurt and you're like, how do you get 120 pims, Sheldon?
I don't think there was a lot of 10-minute misconducts.
Was it all twos?
It was a lot of cross-checking, a lot of slashing. You know, even I experienced it with you. You're going to come and, you know, cross-check me and you want to go. I'll cross-check you back. I don't want to fight you, but I'm going to stand my ground, right? And all right, you guys are both gone for two. Okay. You know, come back to the bench and thank God. I remember the one time that you were looking for action against us. I was scared to death of you. And I remember Mac T yells at me from the bench, hey, you better not. And I'm like, okay. Thank God, coach. You just saved me. So it was a lot of like penalties in there of just being tough. I also think like after the lockout in 2005, when the rules started changing, my PIM started going down because now you can't hook a guy on the arm. Like, you used to cross check a guy in front of the net and knock him flat on his butt and your coach would say, hey, great shift. Right. So a lot of those, a lot of just playing rugged and tough. And, you know, with that, the flip side of that too is, if you're doing something to the team that's valuable, which is, you know, getting points or playing the power play, your leash gets a little bit longer with some of the other stuff that you can do, right?
Yeah.
If you're that sixth defenseman and you're that fourth line winger, you don't even want to touch anyone because you don't want to get a 2-minute penalty and then sit your butt on the bench for the rest of the game, right? So I had a little bit of that too. I had a little flexibility in my game where they still wanted me to be, you know, have a mean streak, but still wanted me to play all the power play. So it was just a little figuring that out, you know, for a season or two and what I could get away with, what I couldn't. And, you know, slowly that declined and I could play more. And the rules were changing. You know, yeah. The rules were changing.
What was it like spending $1.2 million and only making $1 million? How does that work? Because I'm not an accountant. What are you doing
that
in Montreal?
That was stressful. Well, that was stressful, you know? Forget the anxiety away from the – that was anxiety away from the rink.
Did you just have a nice place downtown and a nice car or what?
Dude, I was just young and it's probably an exaggeration. I was, you know, still making a little bit of money. But I just couldn't believe, you know, where I come from – no one had and no one is supposed to play in the NHL.
Yeah.
So I was really just like, I was enjoying it all. I was enjoying the life of being a professional athlete and, you know, being in New York and going to Sports Illustrated parties or Maxim parties or, you know, movie premieres or, you know, doing commercials. I was in a soap opera one time. And I remember driving home from this thing, the soap opera, and Lou had found out. and so I see my phone. I say it's the middle of summer. I said, I'm either getting traded or, you know, I'm getting traded. And he said, what? And we're talking like this is July, you know? What the hell do you think you're doing? And you better focus on hockey. And he dressed me down and I was like, wow, this is July. I still got, you know, 2.5 months till training camp. I thought you'd be happy you have a soap opera star in your team. Never mind giving me trouble. But no, he didn't see it that way, but I had a lot of fun. I really enjoyed the life that comes with it. You know, I mean, we do get treated like pretty good.
Well, it doesn't hurt that you're good looking. You know what I mean? I didn't get asked to be on a soap opera and I played with the Rangers. So, you know, yeah, you're a very humble man.
They're going to make a movie about you. Never mind.
But they're not going to get me to play it. They're probably going to ask you, what's Sheldon Surrey doing?
Oh, man. I couldn't they do will. It. It's just too magical, your story.
Is that why you're living in Idaho? You just wanted to step away? You just needed to get away from that life?
You know, when I retired, I mean, I know you said we'll probably talk about the Edmonton thing, but when I retired, I was so done with hockey. I was just done, but I had already, you know, I was living in Malibu in the beach with Chris Chelios. We became good friends. And, you know, I met Wayne Gretzky through him and I was playing on the Oilers at the time. So kind of developing a little rapport with Gretzky and he said, hey, you got to go check out Idaho. This is like 2010, 2011. So I came up here and there's a bunch of hockey guys here. So, you know, Ray Whitney, Brendan Morrow, Kelly Chase, Barrett Jackman, Brett Hall. So we had Doug Waite. So we had a really good contingency of hockey guys up at this particular golf club. I didn't even know how to play golf at the time. But when I came up here, it was a perfect disconnect for hockey. Not that California isn't. But it was it reminded me of Alberta, just better weather, no bugs. The people were really nice. It was a little different than the California vibe. And I just loved it. I've always felt like Idaho is home for me. This is like my favorite place of all the places I've ever been. Idaho's home.
Wow. Well, you mentioned Alberta. Let's just jump into the Edmonton Oilers. Mm-hmm. So you're a free agent coming off a fantastic season with the Habs, set the power play goal record. How many teams are calling you? Every single one? They want Sheldon Surrey in a bad way?
We definitely had some interest leading up. I guess I'll set the table a little bit. So at the end of that season, I had to have shoulder surgery. Okay. And that was like my fourth or fifth one that I was to have. So I wouldn't even have been ready for training camp the next year, right? And so leading up to that, like free agency, not that there was a lot of teams that could call you before, but my agent said, hey, we've done, you know, talked to this team and that team, and you're probably going to have to go in and get a physical. Well, I wouldn't have passed the physical at that time because I just had shoulder surgery.
Okay.
This is like end of May, mid to end of May. And so there was a little trepidation there. And then free agency starts. There was a couple teams that we were heavily invested in. Well, they put out a couple offers to a couple guys, and they were hoping to get one of those guys, and then they would fit me in with whatever was kind of left. Well, the Rangers ended up signing both these guys. And so the other team that I was talking to was the Kings. And then they called me late the first day of free agency and said, hey, we're not going to spend all the money on one guy, because they thought they were each going to get one guy. So I was figuring I was going to LA or New York. Well, the first day things changed, and then all of a sudden it's like, wow, like everything I've been thinking about for this last month is completely, it's gone. And so it took a little while to digest that. Now, as you're kind of taking, you know, I just had another baby, my second kid. And, so that was playing into it, you know, as a single dad, I was going through a divorce. So I kind of wanted to be back on the West Coast. A lot of things went into it.
Yeah.
And so it's taken a couple days, right, to figure it out. And now all of a sudden we're like July 8th and all these teams are wanting me to fly in and do physicals. Well, I know I'm not going to pass a physical. We're open and on. I mean, you can read it right on the friggin' report, right?
Yep.
And so what happened was Edmonton had called me, and we talked, and then you know, I really didn't want to go back to Canada because I knew my ex-wife didn't want to go back to Canada. Edmonton was kind of the only place, because now I would have help from a personal side with my family being there. Mm-hmm. So I talked it over with my mom and dad, and they were really excited. You know, to see me wearing an Oiler jersey was really kind of important to them. And so the more I thought about it at night, you know, there was another team we were talking to, and Edmonton just kind of came up a little bit in the money, and it just made sense. They didn't care about my shoulder. I didn't have to fly in anywhere. They didn't care. Kevin Lowe knew I wasn't going to be ready for training camp. It just was the easiest, and it made a lot of sense at the time. Yeah, exactly. It just made sense at the time. So when I signed there, I was actually pretty excited. You know, they just lost in the finals the year before. They just lost Chris Pronger. They were looking, you know, to fill a couple holes. They weren't expecting me to be a Chris Pronger, but you know, they'd just gone to the finals with almost the same team, right? So if they could just fill a couple of those roles with guys who could sort of mimic that, then yeah. They thought they would be okay. And so you know, we signed Dustin Penner to an offer sheet that year, and so things were kind of looking up. So I was kind of getting the longer it went on, I was kind of getting excited about things. About being back home.
Yeah, we had Pronger on the show last year, I think, and we talked about his time at Edmonton, and he really didn't enjoy it. he had nothing but kind of he was very polite about it, but he's like, yeah, it was terrible. I was ready to move on from Edmonton. His family didn't enjoy it. He was ready to get out of Dodge. Every time I was a free agent, I'm from Edmonton. I was born there. So
hey, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. So
my mom was born in northern Saskatchewan. She didn't have two pennies to rub together. We lived in the trailer park. We were dirt poor. So and Edmonton always offered me a deal when I was a free agent. But I'm like,
no,
I'm not
going to.
Yeah. Always. Yeah, always. I could have played with you. But something was always just saying, like, don't go to Edmonton. It just didn't seem right. They were selling me the world. Yeah. And I'm just going to underdeliver. Yeah. You get 25 years, 27 schmil. You're happy, you're financially secure for the rest of your life, most likely. What happened? You don't go into detail. I don't care. What happens over the next 3 years?
So I will say this is that Edmonton wasn't my highest money.
Wow.
Sheldon. Contract offer. Yeah.
Who offered you more?
Well, there was two teams. one team on the East Coast that I just didn't want to go. They had a lot of Russian players, and I just didn't think that would be a good fit for me.
And I like your jib because I don't like Russians either.
And there was I just at the time, I just didn't see, like, you know, and plus coming from a team like Montreal where we had just a bunch of great dudes, like we weren't the best team in the world, but we had, you know, Koivu and Craig Rivet. We just had a lot of really good guys. Yeah. And so I just didn't see my fit over there. And now again, we're on the East Coast. So I probably wouldn't see my kids as much. Mac's wife isn't going to want to travel all the East Coast. So, and then there was another team in the West Coast that I just didn't want to play for.
Tim, he still won't name the teams, Tim. My head's screaming. Tell us the team, Sheldon. Tell us who they are.
No, I don't need to bury that now. But
all right.
I will say it didn't really become about a money thing once some of these other things were sounding more appealing, right? The physical, not having to go do that. Kevin Lowe really, we had some really good conversations. So just like you said, I felt like Superman we're going to do a press conference. Funny. We're going to announce you the whole kit and caboodle. Right. And it's so hilarious. I come home and again, I'm just like you. I didn't have much. So we're going to have a press conference to announce you. My dad was like, oh my God, it's like, you know, Wayne Gretzky part two. And so that was good. I was excited. The first day of training camp, the very first day, when you just do the physicals, you don't even step on the ice, right?
Yeah.
So I go to the rink early. I got an early physical with some other veteran guys, Steve Staios and Ethan Morrow and, Dwayne Rolison and Sean Horkup. There's six or seven of us in there having a coffee in the morning, waiting, to go to your physical. And sitting in the training room and just kind of getting to know these guys. And Craig McTavish walks in, and I love Mac D. I love Mac T. He walks in and he looks around and he throws some papers on Kenny Lowe's desk. I remember our trainer, and he says, just the guy I wanted to see. And just the guy I was talking about, he said. And I said, oh, yeah. I said, all good things, right? And he said, no. I said, no. He goes, are you effing kidding me? You're not going to be ready for training camp? Oh, my God. You're just going to sit back on your big contract? He kind of gave me that in front of all these guys.
Wow.
And so I was hot for about a week. Like, he just challenged me in front of these new guys, right? And I'm like, I can't. I said to Kenny Lowe, I go, did he not know the friggin' situation? He goes, no, I thought I told him. I'm like, okay. And so as the story goes, I wanted to come back and play earlier. I'm not supposed to play till November, right? At the earliest, late November. And so now I'm skating, now I'm shooting pucks, and now I'm doing everything that I shouldn't be doing.
Yeah.
And I came back that first year, and I came back early. I played six games. I get in a fight and blow my shoulder out again, you know? And so I missed a lot of that first season. So that was kind of my welcome to Edmonton bit. And I don't think it was Matt. Like I said, Mac T, I love Mac T. I think he's a high character guy. I think it just probably got put on his lap that I wouldn't be ready. And he didn't know, right? And so that kind of goes with the communication, I think, of the whole. It kind of explains the organization a little bit at that time.
Just contrast that to Montreal having Guy Boucher saying, we believe in you. Take your time. Let's work on your shots. Let's work on you. You'll be a better player. You come here, you're their guy. You're the $5.5 million guy, and you have the GM screaming at you before the physical.
Yeah. Well, he was our coach, but
that's right. Your coach. Oh, even worse.
He was the coach. So he came in and he did that. And like I said, it got my hair on my back to stand up pretty quick, and it stayed that way for a while. And so as I'm hurt, that first year, we're playing in that old Northlands Coliseum, Rexall, I guess you played there.
It's a dump. Yeah.
It was a dump. It was the worst place in the league. I had conversations with Kevin about the standard in Montreal. As you've played there. The standard is as good as anywhere in the NHL, maybe the best. So as I told you, I had these two small kids. Well, we didn't have a wives lounge. And so I was making these suggestions like, hey, why don't you take a thing where, because how you have to walk through all the people who are drunk to get out to the rink?
Yeah.
Like you have to walk through these people who are yelling at you, Saray, you bum, and whatever. Yeah. Right. And my kids got to sit in that with my ex-wife, who's already hating life. Not the easiest, person to get along with at that time. And so I said, I made these suggestions. And finally, I was told to shut up, you know, and quit being a silver spooner. And I was making enough money and yada, yada, yada.
You are a silver spooner.
Yeah. I was. Yeah, I got put in my place. And, you know how you have to walk out after the game to that little ramp?
Up
and
it was ramp, all the,
it's all the Oilers' cars. So it's minus 50 out. And you got to, I got to take two small kids and get in this
Ferrari
car that might start. No, it was a Ford truck with a bunch of windshield chips because there's nothing else that's going to friggin' work up there. And so my truck might start after the game. And so I suggested, hey, why don't we hire a couple kids, start our cars when the game's over, and they can just pull in by the bus or at least get our cars warm.
Yeah.
Well, how are we going to do? How are we going to organize that? I go, I'll tell you what, my two cousins, if you give them a ticket to the game, they'll do it for all of us. Like, it won't cost us a thing. No, just stick to what you know. Okay. So that's kind of what I was going through, the, you know what I mean? Like, that's kind of the experiences I was having one after another. And then the next year I got healthy and, you know, did our thing. And so that was 3 years. Next year I had a fine year. The end of that third year, the beginning of it, I think it might have been the opening game or a couple games, and we're playing Calgary. I'm going back for an icing. Me and Jerome McGinley are skating back, who I love, Jerome too. Classy dude. He goes to poke for the puck. He catches my skate. I go on the end boards. I get a concussion. I miss like a couple months. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know about you, because I think you're a smart enough guy, and you are a very, you don't have to be told what to do. Mm-hmm. I've never had a coach tell me to go fight somebody. I just have never had that. Like, hey, you know, you guys, if you and Weller and Boogie get out there and they put me out there, they're not telling me to fight. I know what the situation is, right? We're not stupid. And so I came back that year in January, I think, and we're playing Calgary. We're losing 5-1 after the, you know, second period. And I'm going out, walking out the tunnel, and I'm the last guy to go out. And, Tom Rennie kind of pulls me by the jersey and goes, hey, if you want to get even, now's the time. And I was like, okay. So I went out. I said, Jerome, we got to do this. He goes, yeah, well, okay. I don't even know why we're fighting, but okay. And I ended up breaking my hand. And so all this stuff is going on still with Edmonton, right? All these things of like being a silver spooner and da, 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 da. And so I'm living in LA. I have a place in LA. Olympic break is coming up. Mm-hmm. So I say, hey, I want to go back to LA and have someone who's done this surgery a million times at Curlin Job or wherever to do this surgery. They say, no, you're doing it in Edmonton. And at that time, the CBA hadn't changed where, you know, we had a right to a second opinion. It was like the team had whatever the team says is what you do. You're under contract. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I get these pins put in my hand. I get to go home back to LA. In 10 days, the Oilers are playing the Kings, and then we have 2 weeks for Olympic break. I see this doctor for LA, and he says, they didn't put, you know, a certain kind of cap on those pins. So like the pin isn't, they were getting stuck in my skin.
No,
like
kidding.
He didn't put that. Yeah. So he's like, oh, that's kind of weird. And so we'll do that. We're going to put these caps on, like, something seems pretty simple, right? I'm like,
Basic.
So Olympic break goes on. I'm coming back to, I got to go back to Edmonton. The team's in Nashville. We're going on a road trip. So they leave a couple days early. I got to go back because I'm getting close to being cleared by the doctor. So I got to meet a doctor in Edmonton. So I get to the airport. Now, the day before I'm flying back to Edmonton, I'm in the shower and I look down on my hand and these pins are sticking out 2 inches from my skin, like they're sticking out of my thing. So I'm like, well, that's weird. So I just push it back in like a hot knife through butter. It doesn't hurt. I don't even feel it. It's like I didn't even think anything of it. So a couple times during the day, these pins are coming out and I'm pushing them back in. I call the doctor, hey, I got these pins coming out. Well, you're coming in tomorrow, you know, I'll see you tomorrow. Okay, good. So the next day I go to the airport and I check in. I just have a over the shoulder bag and I check in and I go to sit down in the airport lounge and I can't put my elbow on my elbow kind of hits the armrest. And I look and my elbow is kind of swollen like a golf ball. And I go, I don't remember doing anything, but whatever, right? On that flight now, I'm getting sick. Like, I'm starting to get sick. By the time I got off that flight, I couldn't lift my arm. That's about a three-hour flight. The trainer meets me at the airport. He has to take my bag off the conveyor belt because I couldn't lift it. And I'm like starting to get like delirious, I'm sweating. He's like, "You okay?" I go, "I don't know. You know, it must have been something I ate, whatever. My arm's like this." He goes, "Okay." So I go home. I'm going to get a massage that night. So I sit down in the table. The girl comes over to give me a massage. Probably 3, 4, 5 minutes in, I get up. I go, I can't stop sweating. I'm sick. That night, I take a blanket and I put it over this heater, and I'm shivering. And I called the trainer and I said, "Hey, dude." No, I didn't call the trainer. I called the doctor. I said, "Hey, I'm really sick." He said, "Well, can you drive yourself to the hospital?" I said, "Yeah, I think so." So I call my dad, right? And my dad, he lives 45 minutes out of town. He comes and gets me. I go to this clinic. The doctor meets me there. Well, I got a really bad staph infection. So I got an ambulance. The ambulance now takes me to the U of A hospital. Now I'm in the ICU for 4 days.
Holy moly.
I got a bone and a blood infection, and they're talking about amputating my hand. They have to recut my hand open. They cut from my middle finger down to about here at the end of my palm on both sides. They got to splint it. Well, now I can't move it, but they splint it back open, and it's just oozing pus. And I'm on all sorts of antibiotics that they give cancer patients. Like, dude, it was bad. But the team's on the road, right? The team's on the road now. And so I hadn't had a chance to even call the trainer and really explain what was up and all that kind of stuff. So I don't completely blame it on them, but my buddy comes in one day, and he was our strength coach, and he said, "How you doing?" "Well, I'm in the ICU now, right? I'm hooked up to all this stuff." They had to put a PICC line in through my bicep and go on my heart, and they just dropped antibiotics on my heart so I didn't die. I said, "What are they going to do? Cut my hand off?" And she goes, "Oh, honey, we're not even worried about that. We're worried about this getting to your heart." And at that moment, I put my head back on the pillow and I was like, damn, like this is serious. So the strength coach comes in and he says, "How you doing?" I said, "You know, I've been better." And he said, "You know, I said, "Have you told the coaches or the management?" He said, "Yeah, but they think that you're milking an injury because you don't want to play for the Oilers again." I said, "Okay." So I picked up the phone. Now you gotta understand, I'm on all this painkillers. I'm on these antibiotics. I'm sitting in the hospital, and I left Kevin Lowe and Daryl Cates a message, a voicemail. And I wasn't happy. And so I'm in there for 11 days. I get out. Now I'm carrying a fanny pack of this pump of antibiotics for 14 weeks. Okay, showering with my hand up like this because I can't get it wet. Okay, that's almost 3 months. It's 3.5 months. And so my year-end interview, I tried to fight Steve Tambellini, who was our GM at the time. I'm like, we had a tough one. And so my year-end interview, I kind of said, "Hey, you know, I think it's probably best for me to move on, but you know, we'll talk about that this summer." Okay. Headline the next day, Saray demands trade, whatever. I go back to LA to get out of it.
Crazy.
Now it's like, it's out of sight, out of mind. I don't care about these guys. They don't care about me. So I have a great summer of training. I'm feeling good. I'm like, I'm going to go to training camp and I'm going to kick some ass and, you know, get some value back for me so they can trade me. Obviously, there's no going back after that. We weren't gonna, you know, shake hands and sing kumbaya and everyone's gonna move on. That was we kind of were crystal clear. So I go back to Edmonton. You know how you skate with the team a couple days before training camp and you kind of get back to it. So I go and I skate and flying out there, you know, a couple goals. I'm ready to go now.
What are the guys saying on your team? Because obviously, are like, is Tambellini and Lowen talking to them? Be like, Shuri's ditching us. He wants to leave. Sheldon's just, he's checked out. What are the guys saying in the room?
No, the guys knew what happened.
And, okay.
You know, the guys knew what was happening. They all came to me and said after I, you know, did that interview at the end of it, hey, you know, at the end of the season, you know, whatever I said, you know, me and management were just,
yep.
I don't see it working out, whatever. The guys were all, oh man, that's, you know, that's great. And thanks for sticking up, you know, and the training staff and yada, 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 yada. No problem, boys. And then swear to God, this is a true story. So Pat Quinn calls me in his office and we have a conversation. He's like, hey man, I completely get it. If you want to go somewhere else, you got some family stuff and whatever. He goes, I think you guys have the right to make those things. I appreciate you, you know, you playing hard for us and whatever. Yeah, Pat, thanks. He goes, and good luck with everything. Well, now I'm sitting in the training office to get my exit physical. And I'm looking up at the TV and he's giving a press conference saying, if we don't want guys here that don't want to be here, they can get out of town. I'm like, wait a minute, dude. I was just in your office 10 minutes ago and that's not the conversation we had. So now I'm like, whatever, whatever. So the guys were fine. And yeah. When I came back, the guys, you know, like I said, I was ready to go. I was in great shape. The guys were like, you know, I can't believe we're, you know, let's get a good start. Just the normal shit.
Yeah.
So my agent calls me that night and he says, hey, we got some news for you. And I said, yeah, what's that? He said, you're not invited to training camp. I said, what? He's like, yes, Steve, Tambellini called and said, you're not invited to training camp. I said, okay. I said, well, I'll call Kevin. So I call Kevin Lowe. They're at like the rookie camp in Penticton. They're flying back that night. He says, I'll be at your house at 6 a.m. tomorrow for a coffee. I said, perfect. So he comes in and he says, hey, look, you know, you're going to have to go publicly apologize. You're going to have to ask. You're going to have to talk to Daryl Cates, you know, and tell him what you said wasn't true and this and that. And I said, I'm not doing that. I said, well, I don't think you'd be on the team then. I said, oh, that's up to you guys. I'm ready to go to work and I'm ready to do, you know, do what I have to do. But that's totally up to you guys. You guys owe me for two more years of service, right? You guys still owe me $12 million. So whatever you guys decide, that's up to you. And so the next day I'm going to fly back to LA. I'm working out with the team in the morning at this gym and Daryl Cates is there. So I go up to Daryl and I said, hey dude, is this what we're doing? Like, and he said, well, I'll talk it over with the guys. And then they never got back. So I fly back to LA that night. The rest is history. Well, now we're not even going to send you to the minors because you're, you know, a bad influence on the kids. We're going to send you to another organization in the minors. And it got that petty. You know what I mean? And I'm like, all right, I just came off a great season. And if that's the way it is, I'm going to go down there and be a good soldier. I'm going to still make a lot of money. And this isn't the end of the road for me, you know? And so that's what happened. You know, three games in, you know, you go to the minors. I was a big league guy and guys are challenging me.
Like, no, it's a target, yeah.
Shift. And so finally I get in a fight to break my hand on this kid's head again. And I ended up calling because now Kevin Lowe and Steve Tambellini aren't even responding to my calls. So I called the assistant GM and I'm like, he calls me actually. And he says, hey man, I'm really sorry to hear about the injury. I go, what did you think was going to happen? Like, what did you honestly think was going to happen? So did that. Then I get, you know, a guy takes out my knees and I sprained my knee that year. And it just was one debacle after the other. It was the most challenging year probably of my life, professionally for sure. And, you know, so I assume I'm going to get bought out that year, that summer. Right. And so the buyout period comes and goes and I don't get bought out. I go, oh my God, is this going to happen for another year? Like, I just didn't see it going on that long. And what happened was they ended up having another buyout window. There was some language in there that did it. So they ended up buying me out that last year. And it was just good riddance. I'd never talked to anybody again from that organization. And July 1st, you know, Joe Neuwendijk from the Stars said, hey, you still got some left in you? I said, dude, I'm ready to go. And, you know, the rest is kind of history. It's crazy, right? And at the time, like, I didn't need everybody to know the details like this because nobody cares, right? At that time, yeah. Nobody cared. I was the spoiled brat making a bunch of money and I didn't want to play in Edmonton. And that wasn't true. Like I said, the opportunity that was presented in Edmonton sounded like that could be a really cool thing for me from being from there. And so the narrative was what it was. By that time I was over it and, was looking forward to a fresh start.
You need a movie on your life. That's insane. That's absolutely insane that someone like you're not just as Joe Schmo. You're not like making a mill. Do you think it, man, that's wild.
I learned a lot about business that day. You know, I learned a lot about the machine that day, and it really changed my perspective. Now, not everyone operates like that. I understand that, right? But there are people who do, and there are teams that do. And I didn't even have a chance to play my butt off and get put on waivers and get called back up because I was hurt all year in the minors. And I had no conversations with the team. There was no like checking in. Hey, you know, we got something cooking with the Rangers or Washington. Nothing. It was just a year of, you know, and so I had a lot of time to sit and think in a hotel room in Hershey, Pennsylvania, about what was happening. And the only thing I could control is how I reacted to it. And it was not easy. I didn't want to give anyone anything more to say that I was a bad character right. guy. I just didn't. So you got to go down there and, be a professional and do your job. And that's kind of what I tried to did. And it ended up being a pretty fun year. Wasn't ideal, but you kind of make the best. Still playing hockey.
Yeah.
Still making a lot of money in the minors. And, I didn't have to dress up for games. I was wearing a tracksuit every day. So, you know, there were some benefits.
No escrow.
Yeah,
which was great. Same thing. I got sent down to Newfoundland when they were trying to annex me to not go to the All-Star game. Not quite the same, but similar. Where they're like,
"Yeah,
AHL, we don't want you." Saying all this stuff, these stories about Edmonton and how it's just this a little dysfunctional, and Prong said the same thing. It got me just solidifies that it's a trickle down effect. You could have the best team in the world. You could have the highest payroll, multiple first overall picks, and you're still going to suck. Because you have a dysfunctional president, your GM doesn't know what he's doing. The whole staff is just, it just doesn't work. Whereas you go to New Jersey and you have something that works. The president, the GM, the captains, everybody, it's just completely different. And it's just obvious. Like Edmonton, you didn't have bad teams. You didn't have bad players. It was just dysfunctional. Yeah. The little things.
Weren't the worst. You know, there's another thing that happened. I'm just thinking about when you said this is Edmonton had an alumni night. And so they invited all the players who played for the team at one point, one game or 1,000 games, you know, everybody from Gretzky all the way down. And I get a text from, it was either Ethan Morrow or Steve Staios. And they said, hey, you coming to the alumni game, alumni night in Edmonton for the home opener.
Yeah.
I said, what's that? And they're like, dude, everyone got invited. Check your email. So I text the PR guy and I say, hey, is this happening? He said, yeah. And I said, oh, I didn't get anything. He goes, yeah. And I go, oh, okay. Like, okay, dude, every alumni, Pronger, you know, everybody. And it was just kind of the pettiness that it went to. I will say this before you move on from this is that the Oilers played the Vegas Knights. I live in Vegas in the winters now, right? And I hosted a couple guys for golf, Kenny Holland and Keith Gretzky and their assistant GM and Stevie Staios, who's working close to Ken Holland. And they just ooze professionalism. Kenny Holland is, you know, right up there with Lou Lamoriello, I think, in the way that the way he does things and the respect he has league wide. And it really restored a lot of faith back in the Oilers and the way he talked to me you know, he wasn't there for any of it, but at least I had a better feeling that the Oilers are in good hands. They're in good hands. They got an owner who's an idiot, but they have good people in place. And, you know, I think their window, they have the two best players in the world. So their window is now, but you still, there's a level. And I know you've dealt with it for many years is there's just an obvious level of professionalism from the guys who are really respected to the guys that you just are forgotten.
Yep. And you avoid. I said it for years. And one of the reasons I didn't sign there was it was just since the old boys club, you're like, well, these guys won multiple Stanley Cups. They must be good at, you know, hockey and management and stuff. It's like, no, you're not. That doesn't translate with everybody. So crazy, Sheldon.
Yeah, buddy. Yeah. It was an interesting time. You know, I've experienced the highs and the lows of it. Also, that was probably one of the biggest things for me during that experience is it really deflated my ego. It hurt at the beginning thinking that I would fake, you know, not wanting to play to get traded. But it was a real blow to my ego. Like, how could they do this to me? Which again is what I just said. It really gave me a perspective on the business side of things. I'm not that important. If they're going to do this to me and make an example of me and not care about, you know, tens of millions of dollars, you know, what are they going to do the next guy? And so, it was really humbling. And, you know, but as low as that was, you know, the second free agency opened, you know, I was having a conversation with Joe Nieuwendyk. So again, someone believes in you. And I said, yeah, he goes, you still want to play? And I said, let's go.
Hell yeah.
And that was it. And so I got that opportunity. And for that, I'm thankful because I would have hated to go out the other way, you know?
It's funny, before this interview, the last kind of interaction I had with you was when you played for Edmonton, you beat up Craig Weller and you used a weapon on your hand. We don't have to get into it. You were just absolutely, it was really, really egregious. But I was like I wanted to rip your head off and our whole team did.
Yeah.
You had your hand injury. You came back and you had a plastic sheathing on your left hand and you just dropped bomb after bomb on Wellesley's face with this. Basically, it was like, have you seen Thanos? It was a Thanos metallic hand that he was using.
Boy.
But it's all fine. I'm happy to kind of put those thoughts aside. You're actually a pretty nice guy. Because I was like, this story is a cheater and he's trying to injure people, but it's nice. It's nice. A silver spooner.
I'm a silver spooner. I'm a bad cheater. Teammate. I don't know if you remember, Weller didn't play that much that game. And in the third period, I had a giveaway. You guys ended up scoring. Now it's 3-1.
Yeah.
And so he came out and he said, you ready to go? And I go, I didn't know you were playing. And he gives me the stick in the groin.
Yeah.
And I go, and then it was a false drop the puck. So we kind of squared off. Yeah. And then Ethan tried to jump in. And
that, like, which was funny. Know, and you're like,
it was kind of, I'm like, no, I got that. You got Scott. I got this guy here.
Oh, you gave me to Ethan Morrow. I would have beat that guy's doors off. But that's fine. Did you ever get suspended for that or anything come of that or no? Because I know you had to tell your case to whoever was the your safety people.
The NHL. Well, I played in the All-Star game not long after that. And I had a meeting with Bettman, Daly, and what's the guy? Campbell. He Colin. Was in charge of the Colin Campbell.
Campbell. Piece of garbage. And, anyways.
Yeah, so they asked me about it. I showed him it was a wrist guard that I had that went through my hand and it kind of came around my wrist. Like I was saying, I had that scaphoid injury, so I had to play with it.
Yeah.
And then they seen it and I'm like, you know, it has nothing to do with punching a guy, you know. But they did say, and it was one of the things that actually happened when I fought a Ginla. They did say, if you're going to get in a fight, take it off. And so I never got suspended for it. They just said, you know, if you're going to participate, take it off. So
it doesn't do anything, but take it off. That makes sense. Cause it was a weapon, Sheldon, the animal.
Oh, I should have put him on both hands. If that was
I should have just fought you. You should have fought me or Boogie.
Yeah. Good one.
That would have been, you know, the mainly thing to do. All right, Tim. Tim likes to do a little rapid fire. We can wrap this up. We've been keeping you a long time. I know you probably wrestle a bear in Idaho or something, right, Tim?
Yeah, so just five or six rapid fire questions here. Is there anyone in the league today that reminds you of a young Sheldon Soiree?
Hmm.
Hmm. In the league that reminds me of a young Sheldon Surrey. I don't watch a ton of hockey, but I like this kid from Las Vegas. He plays a little bit of a rough and tumble game, and he can shoot it. I think he's a good teammate. I like watching him. He kind of catches my eye when I watch him play. I think he's a much better player than I was, but there's not a lot of guys who that I know of who really play kind of the, you know, there's no Scott Stevens really in the league anymore. I don't, if there is, maybe you guys could name
a guy who's similar but doesn't have your offensive upside is Jacob Trouba, who goes out there and plays the meat. Like, he hits, but he doesn't have your offensive upside. So I would see a guy who potentially could be, but he had fallen like a Rasmus Ristolainen potentially, but he's not as good as you were. Yeah, you were a rare breed.
I think he was a little more, you know, it was also for me, and I like that you said Prongs, like, man, there was a lot of guys who were doing that job. Shea Weber, Zdeno Chara, Chris Pronger. There was a lot of guys that, you know, I would have had to play better than to you know, get in the Norris Trophy race or something like that. So there was a lot of guys to kind of model my game after at that time, who I kept my eye on in the stats. And they're like, well, you know, Weber got 2 assists last night and I got to, you know, have a good game tonight. So when I played, there was guys that I followed and wanted to be like.
What was your favorite subject in school?
Recess.
Just a meathead.
Just an idiot. I like this. I like to lean on my locker with my leg up and, hey, ladies.
Hey, babe.
Hey, spraying on some Obsession cologne. Hey, Obsession cologne.
Who is your favorite D partner of your career?
I would say Scott Stevens when I played with him, like on a penalty kill or something. But my D partner that I played the most with was Craig Rivet. I love that guy. We were similar players. I just love him. I still talk to him. I have all the respect in the world for that guy. He had to do some heavy lifting when I was out trying to get a bunch of points. I wasn't. I lacked a little bit in my defensive game some nights, and so he had to pick up the slack a lot of nights, and he still reminds me of it.
Which people, that Erik Karlsson winning the Norris this year, what are your thoughts on that? The guy didn't step foot in the D zone.
That's a lot of points, though. I mean, I don't know what the criteria is nowadays, right?
Which points?
But it's like when you see that many points from a defenseman, that's like insane. You know,
put him on Edmonton. Minus? What was your biggest minus year?
I was minus 28 the year that I had 64 points.
Isn't that funny how that works?
Had a bunch of power play points.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we were just a lot of empty net goals, like I will say, it's not that I got put on highlights a couple times, but I think there was so much attention on like my offensive side of the game at that time. So some of my defensive things, critics, like, you know, someone from Toronto or whatever would be like, this guy sucks defensively.
Oh, I would have called you to the carpet. I would have said you were so bad.
I was like, whatever. How many goals do you have?
Chicks dig goals, man. They don't care about plus minus.
I got 26 goals. Relax.
Who was the forward that you played against that was hardest to shut down or contain?
Everyone.
Oh. All right. Follow that up with a minus question, huh? Dude, honestly, the best player I have ever played against skill-wise is Alexei Kovalev, skill-wise. And by the way, people forget that this guy was 6'3", 230, Alexei Kovalev. And he could, man, he used to sit on his knees. We know he'd stretch after practice and everyone's kind of sitting around the circle. And he used to grab 3 or 4 pucks and used to saucer them and land them on the top of the net. Oof. You know, on his knees, dude, it was, I would say that he made me a better player just in practice. I would say that he was, you know, the problem is some nights you just didn't know what you were going to get. And maybe that could be said about all of us, but he's definitely the most talented guy I ever played with or against, for sure.
I was thinking about that when you were talking about Niedermeyer and Stevens and stuff. People see what they do during the games, but I got the possibility, the option to play with Keith a couple games and Brian Campbell and stuff. And these guys, they're good on, you know, on game day, but in practice, that's where you really see how good these guys are. Like every pass is on the tape. Everything is crisp. They don't mess up. It's crazy. So yeah, I can't imagine playing with Kovalev.
High tempo. I will say that it was my last exhibition game. My first year, we're playing in the Rangers in the Garden. It's Gretzky and Messier on the team, and it's a preseason game. And so they come down and whatever, 2-on-1, and Gretzky passes to Messier in the net. And so I'm sitting in MSG and I'm looking at the thing up top, the, you know, the screen. And it's like Gretzky to Messier, and I see my number on there, and I get walked and they score a goal, and I get the tap on the shoulder. I look back and it's Larry Robinson, our D coach. And he said, Hey, the game's right out there. I'm like, oh, sorry, buddy. But I was like, that was such a great moment for me, right? Gretzky to Messier or Messier to Gretzky in the net. I was like, wow, this is, who would have thought?
Robinson, one of the best coaches ever. That guy's
ever.
I had him in San Jose. He was such a nice guy.
He's the best, especially the guys like us.
Yeah.
He was awesome.
All right, Tim. Sorry. I'm hijacking your rapid fire questions here. Go ahead.
Two more questions. We've joked about this already, but if there was a movie made about your life, what actor would play you?
Oh, what actor would play me? Well, I would probably like Jason Momoa to play me.
I like it. You got
that's
the hair now.
A little bit of a stretch.
Okay, what are you going to say, Scott? Yeah, okay, well.
Well, someone thinks he's for someone you? Who's so humble, for someone who's so humble to say that, I'm like, easy, pump the brakes here. Like, you know what I mean? Who's that guy, Tim, in the heist?
He's Jonah the guy. Hill. I want Jonah Hill to play me.
No, though, there's a guy who looks like you. He's in the heist where him and Denzel Washington, I can't think of his name, but for me, they, you know who wanted to do it was Wolverine, Hugh Jackman, but we couldn't make the schedules work out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I don't know.
You guys look a lot like each other.
Same height.
You're a real like great guy. This will be the last time.
Hugh Jackman, I would have Barrett Jackman play you.
Gosh, this is my show. You know what I mean? This is not how it's supposed to go.
This is fun. You guys need another co-host? I'll do this every week. Let's go.
No, we don't need any of this crap. Every guest lately has just been roasting me. Are you friends with Ryan Reeves from Vegas?
I love Rebo.
He's another a-hole.
He's a beauty. That was a great interview. It's so fun when you can do things like this. Like I will say, you guys have an awesome podcast. You know how it is. It's really fun for us to be able to come on here and have a little personality and be able to talk to you and like we trust you with what we're going to say.
Yeah.
And it's just fun that people can kind of show their personality, because for a long time you couldn't. If you showed personality as a hockey player, it meant you were selfish. And
it's good that you're coming on the shows lately. Our theme has been the most overpriced players and the worst contracts ever given out. So you and Ryan were kind enough to come on during this segment of the show, which is great for you guys. You know, hats off to you, because it's takes a big man to say, you know what, I didn't live up to my contract. Yeah. Right, Sheldon?
Yeah, and you know what? I don't care. I'm sitting in Idaho right now. Some of that money that, you know. What do they pay you? Whatever they think you're worth, right? So every contractor, all those good years I had, if you go back and look, they were all contractors.
And you know what? I wish I would have signed at Edmonton, because I could have got, like, if you're on the power play in Edmonton, I could at least been second unit.
I think that you and Steve McIntyre probably would have played. You guys would have switched off depending on the night who we're playing. He would probably play if we needed someone faster on the forecheck. You'd probably play if we needed some block shots.
I had this argument with a lot of players. I was just surprisingly fast. In on the forecheck, I was always first guy in the puck. Yeah. Yeah.
All kidding aside, I did have a lot of respect for you, because you worked on your game. You played hard. You weren't a bully. You know, you're pretty honest. And I always appreciated that about some tough guys, right? There's some guys who go around and, you know, Darcy Hordichuk would always skate, and I just had no respect for the guy.
They try to embarrass you. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, if I don't want to fight, you're not going to stay on me. And, you know, and I always appreciated that about you. And I really, honest, while you're giving me so many compliments, I guess I'll return it to you. I really did love how that all happened with your year with the All-Star game. And you still have to go out and play it. This is what people forget, right? The story's not already written. You still have to go out and play, and you have to score a couple goals, and you have to do your part. When you get there and you're with the best players in the world, you still have to make it that fairy tale. And you did. So I'm happy for it.
I still have to go out and go top shelf on Braden Holtby. You know what I mean? It's just.
Yeah. No, trust me. I do know. It's a tough job.
One more, Tim. Let's get this guy out of here.
Last question. We have a lot of young kids that listen to the show. What advice do you give them about becoming a better hockey player?
Well, if it was my own kids, I would say try every sport. You don't need to play hockey every day of the year. You can try other things. I think that playing baseball made me a better hockey player, hand eye, swinging a bat. It got me out of thinking hockey all the time. I think that some parents now, it's just hard. It's a lot of pressure on kids to always be so intense at 10 or 11 years old, even younger, to just have a one-track mind. And then it's just the obvious thing, right? You got to have fun. If it's not fun and your heart's not in it, it's really tough to get to the top of somewhere when everyone around the world wants that job and they're willing to go places that you might not be willing to take yourself. And so I would say have fun with it and try other things and don't get burned out on one thing.
Great advice. Renaissance man in every sense of the word. Intellect, just brute strength. Sheldon Surrey, thank you for joining us, man. This was a pleasure. I hope you enjoyed it. All kidding aside, you're a great dude. This was awesome.
Thank you, brother. Thanks for having me on. Tim, thanks, man. You do a great job carrying this show.
Just one
last I try. Song. Someone's got to do it, you know? Not easy.
On that note, right, thanks boys. For joining us. Yeah, thanks, everybody. Have a good day. Cheers.
See you, boys.
Thanks for listening to Dropping the Gloves with John Scott, a member of the Nation Network of Podcasts. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from to never miss an episode.